Live coverage from the Captain Cook Hotel of the National Transportation Safety Board inquiry into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. I'm Bruce Melzer. I'm here with Corey Flintoff, and we're doing gavel-to-gavel coverage of today's hearings. We started at 7:30 this morning, and we will go until it's over today. This is the last day of the hearings. This is brought to you by KSKA Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN.
The time is 29 minutes before 11. This is KSKA Anchorage, listener-supported radio serving South Central Alaska.
And where are you stationed?
Coast Guard Marine Safety Office, Valdez, Alaska.
And what are your duties there?
I am the Maritime Defense Zone Contingency Planner, and within that, I also act as the Operations Officer, the training officer, and additionally the personnel services officer, which is the admin department.
Mr. Woody will ask you some further questions.
Good morning, Mr. Rice. How do you hear me?
Fine now.
Mr. Rice, would you describe your position at the Marine Safety Office in Valdez?
As the operations officer, I have two divisions that work within that department, the Vessel Traffic Service Division and the Communications Division. Through those two divisions, we provide the services of the VTS and also the search and rescue coverage for Prince William Sound. In addition to being the operations officer, I am the classified material security custodian. In addition to that, I am the, now because of recent personnel changes, I'm the personnel services administration officer. The supply and the admin department both come under me. Currently.
These changes that you mentioned, are those a result of personnel cuts at the Marine Safety Office?
Well, there's been two series of changes, the more recent of which is just the normal permanent change of station rotation of unit personnel that won't be replaced until the end of the summer. But I have picked up additional duties as a result of last summer's budget reduction and billet reduction.
Did you receive a substantial increase in the number of tasks that you have because of that billet decrease last year?
I wouldn't say a substantial increase in tasks. I received a lot of additional titles that don't necessarily take a lot of time, but I'm more busy now than I was before.
Could you cite a few of the duties that you're assigned that you do require some amount of your time?
The one that requires most of my time currently is the communications material security custodian. That takes up a lot of my time administering our account of classified material. The next one would be the operations department chief job, supervising the communications and the VTS divisions. After that would be training officer. After that would be the personnel services and administration officer.
Do you have any functions as audit officer or maritime defense zone contingency plan?
Yes, my primary billet in the Coast Guard billet manual lists my job as the maritime defense zone contingency planner. What I actually do is what I've just told you. In addition to maintaining the maritime defense zone contingency plans that we have responsibility for, and I am a member of the audit board, and I believe that's about it.
Okay. Of the duties, say following the custodian of the communication material. Which is the second largest task that you have?
After the CMS custodian job?
Yes, you seem to indicate that was your most time-consuming task.
After that, I would say it would be the operations officer task, the supervising the VTS division and the communications division.
And I did mean to ask, too, when did you report as operations officer at Marine Safety Office Valdez?
I transferred into Valdez on April 29th, 1987, and I believe it was around the 1st of June when I relieved as operations officer.
What were your primary duties following the grounding of the Exxon Valdez?
Initially, after the grounding, I was responsible for the tasking and resupply of the various Coast Guard ships that were sent into the area for the spill response.
Would you describe the watchstanding procedures in the, not procedures so much, but the assignment of personnel in the Vessel Traffic Center? Who they are and what watches they stand?
Okay, on the Vessel Traffic Center side, there are three GS9 civilian watchstanders. There are two third-class radiomen presently. There is one two third-class radarmen, one first-class radarmen, and a senior chief radarmen. On the radio side of the room, since there are two watchstanders in there, the radio side of the room, there are three radiomen third class, one radiomen second class, and one radiomen first class.
We have heard that you have a qualification and a requalification program, and that there are some problems with the obtaining overtime for the training of civilian watchstanders. Could you give us a few words of explanation of the kind of problems you have with training of civilian watchstanders?
With regard to the civilians, we are limited to a 40-hour work week for them. We've had instructions from our district office in Juneau to minimize the use of overtime whenever we can. We accomplish the training during the overtime periods because of there's a rather complex duty schedule that we have to follow to keep the 40-hour work week for the civilians, because we have a mix of civilian and military watchstanders. I'm sorry, can you repeat your question?
Yes, right. I'm just asking particularly if the training, if you have any problems acquiring overtime, if it must, say, be prior approved, or is there any limitation to how much you can get and that sort of thing?
I'm not sure what limitations have been imposed on it, but we are required to get prior approval before we use the overtime. We can, of course, use overtime in an emergency and then notify the personnel office after the fact. But normally they require us to get approval beforehand, and it hasn't been a problem in the past when we've had to do it.
Does the mixing of civilian and military watchstanders in the Vessel Traffic Center result in any kind of morale problems?
No.
Whenever there's an unexpected gap develops in the watch bill, does the fact you have civilian and military cause you any considerations in filling the gaps?
No, we have four normal watchstanders in the rotation, four standard watchstanders, the three civilians and one of our RD, or radarmen third class. When there is a gap because of leave or an absence due to illness, we fill that gap with one of our standby watchstanders, who would be one of the other radarmen third class or the radarmen first class that we have.
I see. Do either of the military radarmen, are any of those on day work? Like RD1, is he on day work?
Yes, the two standby watchstanders, when they are not plugged into the rotation, perform a day worker function. They work from 8 to 4:30.
And the day workers are drawn from the military?
Yes.
What? organization is small and you've had some personal cuts, I'd like to ask, what percent of the time is your senior chief radarman assigned to other than operations duties? If you could comment on that, please.
Recently, over the last year or so, we've had a need for the senior chief's administrative skills and organization skills in another department. And we moved him into another department at the unit to get that department back on track, get it better organized.
And what department was that?
That was the Personnel Services Department.
Thank you. Now, what percent of his time would you estimate is devoted to the Vessel Traffic Center at this time?
By who?
By the senior chief.
A weekly, daily?
Right, perhaps weekly, monthly, however you'd like to express it.
I'd say probably 5 hours a week.
He devotes 5 hours a week to the Vessel Traffic Center duties. Okay. Is there a need for him to devote more hours than that?
No, sir.
Do you ever make a routine, or do you have a routine of going into the Vessel Traffic Center yourself, say, for an inspection type purpose?
Not so much as an inspection type visit. I go in there quite frequently during the day to find out what's going on, if there's anything unusual, any problems that the watchstanders are having. I guess you could call that an inspection, but it's nothing formal.
In the Vessel Traffic Center manual, and we've also heard testimony about this, there are times when the watchstander will call the OOD. I was wondering if the OODs, who are not necessarily qualified to stand a radar watch, if they are in some manner indoctrinated or trained about VTC operations so that they can assist or give advice to a watch center who might call them.
Yes, sir, they are. They're, the OODs are qualified Vessel Traffic Center watch officers. They are just as familiar, if not more familiar, with the rules and regulations of the Vessel Traffic Center than the radar watch standards. They are not as technically accomplished with the radar as the radar operators are, but they know the rules and regulations. They are given a copy of the Vessel Traffic Center manual. They study that manual. They are then given an open book study guide to complete on the manual.
All right. What grade are the OODs that we're speaking of?
We have currently, as of this week, we just had a new watchstander qualify. I'm sorry, a new OD qualify. We have from E5, which is a second class petty officer, up to a lieutenant, myself.
What guidance in Vessel Traffic Watch Center standards say besides the operation, the VTS manual?
Written guidance.
Written guidance, thank you.
We also have a what's called a pass down log. It's sort of a watch to watch information log. The entries are made in there by the Vessel Traffic Center supervisor and initialed by the CO or the XO.
We've heard that the command has meetings. Does the operation department have periodic meetings of, say, Vessel Traffic Watchstanders?
Yes, sir. Before the spill, I was, with the watchstanders.
Yes. Watchstanders and other members of the operation department.
Well, the watchstanders aren't normally included because they're at home, asleep. We don't like to disrupt their watch routine because it can mess up their body clock. Normally, every Monday morning before the spill happened, I would meet with all the heads of the divisions that come under me and talk about the upcoming week's events, what they had going on, and if I had any information to pass to them.
All right. If the vessel traffic watchstanders were not necessarily included, what provision was made for getting the word out to them?
That would, if they needed to be made aware of anything that was discussed at the meeting, it would go out in the pass down log, or it would be passed word of mouth, you know, from watch to watch. Either way.
Would that involve, if it's passing word of mouth to mouth, so to speak, would that be involve RD1 more in any way?
It could.
Now going now to the radar equipment, would you describe the radar equipment as it was configured at the time of the grounding of the Exxon Valdez?
Well, I was not there in the traffic center at the time of the grounding, so other testimony that you've already had would probably cover that.
Yeah, I wasn't speaking specifically to what range scale was on the radar or anything like this, but what was the capability and how many scopes you have, and what were any limitations that you recall at that time?
There are two radar sites with three radar indicators or scopes. You can punch up any combination of master, slave radars to any console. If you could be more specific, sir, I could give you a better answer.
Certainly. Well, for example, what was the capability to say to plot more than one contact simultaneously?
Well, the for the automatic tracking part, using the Raytheon collision avoidance system, the computer built into the radar, I believe it can track, I'm not sure, I think maybe up to 20 targets simultaneously. And then you can designate a primary target out of those 20 to pick out specific information from the computer on. The RayCAS system in conjunction with the Raytheon data logger could give you a printout of bearing and range at a time interval that you set, so that it would automatically plot. It would automatically record the vessel's range and bearing at a time interval that you set.
I understand. If you had, say, let's just go to two contacts, would they have to be on the same radar screen or same range or same video picture? Were there any kind of restrictions of this nature? Speaking now of the master and slave type combination you had at that time.
I'm not sure, sir.
How would you characterize the performance of the radar at the time of the accident? For example, had it been performing as well as you can recall during your past couple of years at the vessel at the vessel traffic center?
I would say it was performing as it normally did.
Had you noticed any degradation or change in it over the past 2 years that you were at the Marine Safety Office?
I have noticed some degradation, but I'm not a qualified technician to tell you whether it's the radar or the microwave link that brings back the radar video back to the office building. I've seen the radar give an outstanding picture on some days, and then a day or two later be a much degraded picture.
Can you correlate these changes with any matter of tuning or adjusting the radar, a need for such things?
Well, I would say that if the radar wasn't tuned or wasn't adjusted properly, it would give you a degraded picture, if that's what your question is.
Okay. How are radar technicians supposed to know when the radar is in need of some tuning or adjustment?
Well, two ways. They perform a routine preventive maintenance program on the radar. They check it periodically. And also, if any of the operators notice that something is not right with the equipment, they notify the technicians also.
Okay. What other factors affect radar reception?
Well, again, sir, you're asking someone who's not a technician and not a radar operator, but in my understanding, with X-band radar, the type of radar that we have, it's affected by moisture content in the atmosphere, rain, snow, fog. It's affected by the reflectivity of the object that you're looking for, how the object is configured, any number of other things, but I'm not a technician.
I realize that, but are you a qualified VTC watchstander?
Yes, I am. I'm a qualified VTC watch officer.
Watch officer?
Yes, sir.
Would you explain the difference, please?
Yes, sir. The watch standers are also radar operators. Okay, that they know all the rules and regulations like I know them, like I'm familiar with the rules and regulations. But they also are proficient in the use of the radar.
All right. Would the OODs, would they be watchstander qualified?
They are watch officer qualified.
Watch officer
there
qualified.
Are some
I'm
of
sorry,
the
watch officer qualified.
There are some of the ODs that are also watchstander qualified because of their rating and previous experience.
What ratings would these qualified VTC watchstanders be?
That are also OODs?
Yes, they're OODs.
I can tell you who they are. They're Senior Chief Bruce Moores and RD1 James Moore. They're both radarmen.
I see. What about the effects of weather, wind, precipitation, that sort of thing? What effect does that have on the radar?
Okay, I'm going to have to qualify my answer because I'm not a technician. My experience with radar from this tour and from other tours on Coast Guard ships tells me that rain, snow, sleet, fog can have a degrading effect on radar. Wind, I'm not sure too sure about wind other than the wind waves that are generated causing a sea return on the scope that would have to be tuned out so you could see a target. Other than that, wind could, I guess if it's severe enough, tear off your radar antenna. But
I just wondered if you received any reports from your people or when you visit the Vessel Traffic Center, if you noticed any of these phenomena like weather on the radar. And
oh, sure.
Heard any comments from your watchstanders? That's why I was thought you might have a basis to answer the question.
On the night of the grounding?
No, anytime, just generally. Speaking generally now.
Speaking generally, whenever it snows real heavy, which it has occasion to do in Valdez, there is reduced radar coverage because of the water content in the air.
How far could you track a tanker outbound in Valdez Arm during a snowstorm?
Well, again, I'd have to speak from my personal experience of sitting in front of the console. And I would say, in a real generalized case, maybe no more than 5 miles.
I see. And how about tracking vessels through Valdez Arm during snow? Is there ever a time when you can't track them because of snow or weather conditions in Valdez Arm?
Sure. Because of the lack of a radar of a return from the target because of the water, in the air.
And what percent of the time might you have snow that would prevent you from tracking a tanker in Valdez Arm? Can you think of times when you've had to have a ship not proceed through the narrows?
Your line of questioning, wouldn't that be more appropriate for, I mean, the lieutenant has already said that he does not sit and operate the radar. What are you trying to establish?
Well, I'm just trying to establish what he may have in the way of reports that might translate into policy. We have heard that the radar was found to be satisfactory it was checked after the radar, after the accident. I was wondering if it did nonetheless require any minor adjustments that you can recall that your ETs had to make.
None that I know of.
Are you familiar with the field change, too, that we've heard about?
Yes.
About how long did that take to install, and what did it accomplish?
I'm not sure how long it took to install. What it allows us to do now, I have to explain a little bit here first. We have a main microwave system and a standby microwave system. The microwave link is how we get the radar information back to the MSO building. The radars themselves are out at Potato Point. Before Field Change 2 was installed, we had a main online microwave link and what we called a hot standby, or a standby link that was turned on and running but just had no information being passed over it. What Field Change 2 allowed us to do was transmit radar video and control signals over both of the microwave links at the same time. And what that allows us to do is have both, see, there's two radars at Potato Point. It allows us to have both radars running at the same time on whatever scales we choose. Before, we had to choose one of the radars, or we had to choose one radar to use. We could not use both radars at the same time. And by only using one radar, you had to select one scale to use for the master system. If the master was set, now this is, you're probably better off getting a deeper explanation of this from the technician.
All right, thank you. I think that's a good answer. Have you been advised whether this will in any way reduce the amount of redundancy or backup that you have in your radars at Potato Point?
Well, we still have two links out to the radar site, so there is still a backup. However, the backup is now has information being passed over it where before it didn't. It may make the redundant. See, again, that's a question maybe for a technician, but applying common sense to it tells me that if you're using something that's meant as a backup for a primary purpose, that you're taking away from its ability to perform when you really need it as a primary.
Thank you. Now, has the Vessel Traffic Center done any plotting of all outbound tankers during the month of April? And
yes.
If so, could you describe the results that you found?
Okay. Per the NTSB's request, I'm not sure the dates when it started, but we began using the tracking system in the radar in conjunction with the Raytheon data logger to track the vessels to the end of radar coverage. That is to where the acquisition circle would leave the target because of a less than reliable return coming from it. We tracked the vessels from the Alyeska Marine Terminal all the way out to where we lost radar video from them, or reliable radar video. As far as the results of it, I just got a real quick look at the figures, so I can't speak with any authority on them. But from what I remember hearing, the average was about 14.2 miles from Potato Point.
Thank you. How would you characterize the communication system that the VTS system relies on?
Adequate to perform the functions that we're required to.
Are there any particular difficulties or maintenance problems that you can think of that you could relate to us? regarding the communications?
Nothing that would have had an impact on the night of the grounding.
Is the communication system maintained by a contractor?
Yes, sir.
If it were necessary, would your ETs be able to step in on occasion and make repairs to it? Or would there be problems because of the way it's maintained?
With some difficulty, I believe they could jump in and maintain the system if they had to. They would definitely require some additional assistance from another Coast Guard source, but I believe they could.
We've heard terms of plotting, tracking, and monitoring. Would you explain what plotting, tracking, and monitoring mean?
And these are my definitions.
We've heard terms of plotting, tracking, and monitoring. Would you explain what plotting, tracking, and monitoring mean?
These are my definitions of them, as I apply them to how I carry out my job. Plotting is the physical recording of range and bearing of a target of a vessel. And that could also mean plotting it on a chart or a chartlet at the same time. Tracking was the next one.
Tracking.
Tracking and monitoring, I would say, are synonymous. They are basically watching the target on the radar scope and monitoring its progress. They're watching it.
What scales of the radar are customarily used to plot vessels proceeding outbound in Valdez Arm at the time of the grounding?
I'm not sure, sir. You'd have to ask one of the operators.
All right. Do you know what scale the radar was set on at the time of the Exxon Valdez grounding?
I believe from earlier testimony I heard it was...
What you know, if you know it.
No.
Okay. Are there any instructions that require the watchstander to increase the range of the radar to track vessels as far as possible?
No, sir.
How would the watchstander know to do this?
Well, I believe that it would be implicit in a watchstander's... It would be implicit that the watchstander should do that to fulfill his requirement to monitor all the targets that are in the system.
I would like you to call your attention now to Exhibit 7D, a 31 August memorandum by R.D. One Moore.
He has the exhibit, Mr. Woody.
Okay. Would you explain what paragraph 2 means?
Could you be more specific, sir?
Well, the particular part where it speaks of no need to plot vessels at the 15-mile point from Potato Point.
That would be the physical plot I mentioned earlier. That's how I would define that word.
Now, was this directive issued before you had the data logger?
I'm not sure.
Can you furnish any background, any discussions that you can recall to provide background as to why this was considered? Was it, for example, a request from the watchstanders? Was it during the busy season, if you have such a season?
I believe that may have been the case, sir, but I don't recall for sure.
I believe that's all the questions I have at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Woody. Dr. LaResh.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Howitt.
No questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Captain Deppe.
No questions.
Commander Waldron.
Some of the same questions that I asked Commander McCall concerning your understanding of some of the terms. Can a vessel request permission to change traffic lanes to avoid ice when no conflicting traffic exists?
Yes, sir.
Is this, in your opinion, a minor or major deviation?
Minor.
May a watchstander authorize such a minor deviation under the VTC manual without first notifying his OD or commanding officer?
Yes, sir.
Concerning the providing of VTS information, what kind of information, if any, does a VTS provide to a vessel in Prince William Sound?
Information that the vessel would not be able to obtain from the resources that he has at hand in dealing with the safe navigation of his vessel.
Are you aware that the third mate has testified that he knew his position, had a range and bearing on Busby Island, saw Bligh Reef buoy ahead?
Yes, sir.
Based on that information, could the VTS watchstander have provided any information to the Exxon Valdez that it did not already have available to help her and her crew?
No, sir.
Under the VTC manual, is a watchstander supposed to provide vessel with recommended courses or recommendations on how to maneuver?
No, sir.
And again, is there anything that the VTS could have done that would have prevented this grounding?
No, sir, not in my opinion.
A couple of questions on the VTS watch itself. How many men stay on the VTS watch?
There is one vessel traffic center watchstander and one radioman watchstander and the officer of the day.
Can the radio watchstander receive the same radio communications that the VTS watchstander receives?
Yes, sir. He has a duplicate radio console.
If the radar watchstander is outside the VTC, can he be contacted?
Yes, we have a loudspeaker system throughout the building.
What about at night when people in the barracks area are sleeping?
It doesn't matter. If there's an emergency, he'll be summoned back to the traffic center.
How long would it take him to return to the VTC?
Well, the farthest he would go in one of his breaks, allowed for a break, would be down to the galley, which is one floor down. And I would say it would take him at a good trot, maybe 20 seconds at the most, to get back to the traffic center.
Does the VTS watchstander ever leave while the vessels are in the transiting the narrows?
No, sir.
Is there ever a time when the VTC is left unattended?
Never.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commander. Mr. Coluccello?
No questions.
Thank you for your testimony, Lieutenant. You're excused from the stand. I'd like to call our third witness this morning. Chief Bruce D. Moores, Senior Chief Radarman, Operations Department, Marine Safety Office, Valdez. Chief Moores?
You're listening to live gavel-to-gavel coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board's inquiry into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. We're listening to the final day of testimony today, testimony from Coast Guard personnel attached to the Marine Safety Office in Valdez. The witness up now is a senior chief radioman, Bruce Moores.
Bruce D. Moores.
And where are you assigned?
Marine Safety Office, Valdez.
What are your duties?
The assistant operations officer.
Is that the only, do you have some collateral duties?
Several collateral duties.
You tell us those.
Assist in the administration department in the computer field. Stand OD. Command enlisted advisor. Those are major ones.
Mr. Woody will ask you some additional questions.
Good morning, Chief Moore.
Good morning.
When did you report to Marine Safety Office Valdez?
June of 1987.
And did you have to qualify as a Vessel Traffic Center watchstander after your arrival?
Yes, sir.
Would you describe the process that you went through?
I was given the VTS manual, the user's guide, chartlets, and a study guide, and put on watch with a qualified watchstander. I went through the familiarization rides, went through the study guide and answered the questions, became familiar with the watch routine, and then I was interviewed by the operations officer to get his evaluation on my qualifications.
And what was your rank or grade at that time?
Chief Radarman.
Chief Radarman. Would you describe the watchstanding that you've, as you observed when you first reported aboard, give me such comments as to the amount of logs and record keeping that was going on and any policies that existed at that time that you can recall?
There were, and there still is some, duplication of records where an operator would have to record the information several times for several different formats. And it became somewhat of a task to make sure the paperwork was up when you relieved the watch. That was difficult. The separation of the radar indicators from the communications console seemed to be a problem at that time also, as far as a watch standard would go.
Would you explain what you mean by this?
When I had reported on board, the communications console was straight in the door. I don't see the blow up of the picture here, but then there was at 90 degrees to the radar, to the communications console, several feet away were the indicators, and the operator had a tendency of rolling back and forth with a chair to be able to talk on the radio versus watching the radar system.
And what changes did you make?
The present configuration in there was looked at and considered by the operations department as being a feasible configuration to keep it as a one-man watch, allowing the operator to spend more time at the radar indicators, being able to talk and do his paperwork at the same time.
Did you do any streamlining of the paperwork? And if so, can you explain what you did?
Yes, we did. We had what was called a data card, and it basically had the same information. It was in a separate format. What we did is we put it on a full sheet of paper, put it more of a format that's useful in doing up the follow-up reports on different parts of information we needed to get off from that form.
Are you still making any kind of data cards for, say, Vessels and Valdez Arm?
The data cards was just a physical change to the paper. The paper has sometimes been referred to as the data cards or data sheet. It's one and the same. The cards no longer exist. The sheets are being used now to accomplish the same thing.
Has, in your estimation, this resulted in the operator having any more time with the scope?
Yes. That was the intent, was to give the operator more time to be looking at the indicators and less time writing. And now that we have the forum, the information that we need to get off from that can be extracted at a later date. It doesn't have to go to three or four different places as it used to be. And that would increase the time available for the operator to spend at the indicator cell.
I have some questions on the performance of the radar equipment. In the time that you've been at the Marine Safety Office, have you noticed any change in the capability of the radar?
No. I think in order for me to be able to do that, I'd have to stand a tremendous amount of watches and start recording data. There's been nothing visibly that I can look at and say I've seen a distinct change or a trend in performance.
Do you visit the Vessel Traffic Center periodically?
And yes.
So how often?
I try to get in there at least once a day. For the most part, I do in the building, walk through and find out what's going on, what the operators are doing, and to include a communication side.
How many months did you stand watch the Vessel Traffic Center when you first came on board?
When I first came on board, I stood watches. I was considered the emergency watch section that I could go and fill in the event of illness or whatever for about 2 months.
And what months were they?
July and August.
Is this a period of high traffic?
We have fishing boats and pleasure craft and cruise liners in the area that you wouldn't have in another part of the year.
Do you recall any ice during this time?
There was ice. I don't have specifics. I know probably because of being there as long as I have that there was ice there, not that I can remember in particular.
Do you recall from your experience or from reports from the watchstanders whether the radar, how well the radar picks up ice?
I've never had any indication from the operators that the radar system was picking up ice that well. It's not really been covered in conversation.
I was wondering when you receive ice reports from vessels, if you can see ice on the scope most of the time or only a part of the time, or if you could characterize an answer as to how often you do see ice.
Well, personally, I've never tried to correlate that information, and I've never seen ice on the radar myself.
Do you recall ever receiving an ice report and not seeing ice?
I've received several ice reports.
What factors that you've experienced or know about affect the range of the radar?
Realizing that I'm not a technician, that I am an operator, I have to look at it from an operator's point of view. And I think that Lieutenant Rice covered it very much in as far as I could. You know, this weather, sea state, and performance of the equipment, condition of the equipment would be the big factors.
Have you ever known of occasions when you couldn't track a tank vessel through Valdez Narrows?
No, never. We've always been able to track them.
There's a new pilot station, I understand, now in the vicinity of Bligh Reef. I was wondering if you had any knowledge of recent tracking of the radar as to whether you can pick up vessels at that pilot station.
The only thing I've heard on that, I have no personal experience, was that request y'all made to record the data, and I haven't looked at that in detail, but I know it was being done. I don't have the information on that.
Could you provide us a summary of the data and also provide us the data at some future time so we can assess it?
Yes, sir.
I have a couple more questions on ice. Have you, from your experience, known of vessels to have to stop in Valdez Arm because of ice?
No, sir, not personally.
Have you ever known of vessels to have to go outside of the vessel traffic separation scheme?
Not to my knowledge, personally.
Does the fact that a vessel is changing lanes to avoid ice when you were standing watch, did that cause you to do anything differently, to pay more attention to the radar scope, for example?
No, sir. At that particular time, I'd probably be taking an ice report on what he was seeing and realizing what he was doing as a watchstander.
I'd like to refer you to Exhibit 7C and 7D also.
William Woody from the National Transportation Safety Board is questioning Bruce Moores, Senior Chief Radar Man with the U.S. Coast Guard in Valdez.
Whether or not these directives were issued before you had the data logger.
Yes, it was.
I'm referring now to the six-minute intervals here in the in paragraph 3 of your of Exhibit 7C. In the second paragraph, it says, next to the last line, outside the zone, vessels will be designated and true marks at six-minute intervals will be maintained. Is the six-minute interval still being, is that the policy for tracking vessels in Valdez Arm?
Both of these memos were superseded, so to speak, or incorporated in the November 1988 Operatives Manual, or BTS Manual. We would not refer to these. The fact that these were in the past analog was more historical than anything else. Once that document was signed, the operator cannot no longer use this as guidelines. So if it's not in the BTS Manual, the operator is not following it. He's doing what's in the manual. This was an interim.
All right, then. From your knowledge, then, what is the present policy pursuant to the manual?
The present policy is that the operator keeps the vessel acquired until the video is no longer reliable and it drops off the.
And therefore, the six-minute mark is no longer applicable.
Six-minute, as applied in this memo here, the intent was to have the operator look at and take a bearing and range of the vessel at six-minute intervals outside the narrows. And that was due to a period of time where we're getting a lot of input, a lot of verbal discussion going on procedures and policies and recommendations. This, all this did was clarify the operator's responsibility during that period of time until the manual came out.
And the present, would you state what the present policy as you understand it from the manual? Well, according to plotting vessels in Valdez Arm.
Okay, the plotting requirements are, as we say them, and Mr. Rice again, I think, clarified what plotting means. As we applied in there.
Oh, I'm sorry. Give me the policy regarding vessels proceeding outbound in Valdez Arm, whether it's plotting or tracking, if you just state what they are.
Okay, we plot the vessel, the bearing and range of the vessel, manually prior to entering the one-way zone on the outbound vessel. We plot it through the narrows, and once it leaves the narrows, we stop plotting it, okay, and we monitor it.
And would you describe what monitoring means?
It would be watching the vessel.
Yeah. Would it be being tracked automatically by the radar?
The radar would be tracking automatically also, yes. We'd have a course and speed and a bearing and range readout available to us on a digital readout from us.
I have a couple questions regarding the overlay of the vessel traffic separation scheme. Is there a capability for having the overlay on both of the radars, both of the radars that are dedicated to Potato Point?
In the present configuration, I don't believe so. I think it's a hard card that has to be installed in the system.
And which radar is it installed in now?
It's an indicator 3.
That's the radar that was formerly referred to as the slave.
Yes, sir.
Do you have any personal information or recollection of the ice conditions on the evening that the Exxon Valdez grounded?
No, sir.
see, I have one more question regarding the overlay. To what extent was the overlay being used at the time of the grounding?
I do not know.
How is it being used now? Is there any change in its use?
I think people are in tune to the fact that it's there and it's been questioned. I think that's being used as a factor in when they turn it on, when they turn it off. Normally it'll be used when there's somebody approaching or departing now. And when there's nobody there in the sector, it could be turned off.
Senior Chief Morris, I believe that's all the questions I have this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Woody. Captain Deppe?
We have no questions.
Mr. Howitt?
No questions.
Dr. Laresh? Commander Walter?
No questions.
Mr. Colucciello?
Chief, do you think it would be a good idea to have the overlay come on automatically on the scope when you're tracking in the arm so that there's no chance that someone might forget to turn it on or anything?
There are several different options being considered. That would be an opinion on my behalf, and I really don't have one right now. There's a lot of discussion on what could be good and what can be feasible.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you recall when you were a watch standard, did you normally use the overlay or not?
No, sir.
Did not use it. Okay, no more questions.
Mr. Armentrout?
Yes, sir, Chief Moores. When Mr. Taylor was up here testifying, he made a statement that maybe of no consequence, but I just wanted to clear it up with you. He said that the Hinchinbrook and Naked Island sites were down. Are those, and we didn't pursue it any further, are those radio repeater sites, or what was he referring to?
Those are radio repeater sites.
All right, and would that have had any play at all in any of the communications on the night of the mishap?
No, sir.
Okay. And then there's just one other quick thing that I think has almost been clarified, but I wanted it. My military experience says when you really want to clarify something, you either ask a master sergeant or a chief. I don't think we want to leave the impression that the vessels that are participating in the VTS, the system, can leave the lanes, depart through the lanes, without getting prior permission or without informing the VTS operator. Is that not correct?
Yes, sir.
And in the instance where a vessel does not request permission or advise the controller and strays well outside of the boundary and then informs the operator of his position, is that the way to get around having to request permission?
As an operator, you want me to answer that?
Yes, sir.
As an operator, if a vessel was outside of the traffic separation scheme, completely outside, and I had it on radar, I would probably ask him to define his intentions. If he called me and he was not on radar and said it was outside, I would still ask his intentions. And given that set of circumstances you gave me, I would call the OD and ask for guidance. And the OD would in turn do whatever he does to get guidance for the particular situation.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, let's assume that you can't get in touch with the OD. What do you do?
I have the commanding officer, the executive officer.
You would go to one of those?
Yes, sir. I also have the operations officer in there, too.
Were you here for Lieutenant Rice's testimony?
Yes, sir.
He made a comment about the safety board had asked for 30 days worth of tracking of vessels out of the Narrows, and as far as the scope, the radar could pick them up. And I think he said about 14.2 miles from Tata Point. You just said that you've seen some of that information, but you're not You haven't really reviewed it. Is that a fair characterization?
The only thing that I saw was the raw data, and it was in a draft form. I did not have time to go down and set through the figures or anything like that.
Has anybody in your office reviewed that data?
It is a rough draft. They did not finalize it to get it down to a point where it could be readable and interpreted, to my knowledge.
I guess my question is, of the next three witnesses, would any of those three people be, to your knowledge?
I don't know who the witnesses are. I don't believe so, sir.
I'll ask that question three times. Thank you, Chief. Mr. Colucciello, you had one more question.
Just one thing, Chief. You said, do you stand OD watches?
Yes, sir.
Well, because you indicated the answer to one of the questions was that if you were faced with that situation with the ship outside of the TSS, that you would call the OD and ask the OD. But since you are an OD, I would think that you would know the answer.
Knowing the answer and making a decision would be two different phases of it. Knowing the answer would simply know, in my mind, what the commanding officer or the executive officer is going to say.
Tell us what that answer would be, even if that's not going to be your decision.
You would have to find out what the actual situation is, sir. There's too many conditions in it that I wouldn't want to deal with.
Well,
I would have to see it and have all the information available before I could even speculate on that.
Well, see, I thought we had a situation where you were the watchstander. You saw the vessel outside the TSS, and the question was, what would you do? And I think your answer was, I would call the OD, but since you could very well be the OD in some situation, I would expect that you would have an answer to this situation.
Outside
even if you say that's
okay.
Different from the decision,
no.
Which I don't understand.
No, the situation you gave me was outside the TSS. That's in any given point in Prince William Sound. Without, we could go down every latitude and longitude.
Right. Well,
a lot of that would depend on why
right,
he was
well stated, because he might even be going to an anchorage. But let's say he was